Okay, it's 9:01. Well, I hope you saw that the wait was worth it. I have some things to say that others haven't said. So, a number of people emailed me since. Oh, actually, let me lower the picture, the light, so you see me a little better. A number of people emailed me, so I'll spend a few minutes on, first of all, about Rav Avadya Yosef and Kulthum. I have something quite interesting. But before I get to that, I'm going to read you something I found from Rabbi Avraham Shammah. He's a Rav in Israel. And I'll just read it to you. He grew up in, I'm not sure if he grew up in Egypt or in Syria. He says, from my childhood until my adulthood, I do not remember closing my ears, nor was I instructed to do so, and I heard the best music, both from the Orient and the West, even when performed by female singers and even in live performances. Apparently, the principle is based on the fact that there is no intent here for some forbidden pleasure. People have testified to me that there were Torah-observant Jews at the performances of the famous Egyptian singer Kulthum, and even more than that, they listened to her songs and learned them well, even though some of the songs had inappropriate words. Prayer leaders, among them scholars, used her tunes in the prayer services until this day, with the approval of the halachic authorities, who knew quite well the source of these tunes. And that's, I mentioned last class, Rav Bar Shalom quoted Rav Avadya as saying that you, as opposed to Boaz Sharabi, take the tunes of Kulthum and use them in davening. And I also found, I checked the other biography of Rav Avadya, the Maran, and on page 242, it also mentions that this whole thing about, he says that you can use the tunes of non-Jewish singers, including Kulthum. So the question is, what's going on here? Because if you look in Yabia Omer, volume 1, number 6, Arachayim, he states explicitly that you shouldn't listen to women singing, even if it's on the radio, if you know what she looks like. The only thing I can say is that he probably makes a distinction between the type of song, perhaps, and the type of woman singing it. I'm going to play for you right now an example of Kulthum's music, the sort that Rafat Yosef listens to, and says that we could use this in the davening, the tunes, and I don't even know whether we would consider this singing in the way we think of Madonna or Britney Spears, but I'll play about a minute and a half or 2 minutes of it, and you'll get a sense. Okay, so now we have David S. telling us that they used this tune for Adon Olam. I don't know. Is that in the Syrian community? So, obviously for us Ashkenazim, it's a little hard for us to get into a song like that. But if you're from the Arabic culture, it makes a lot of sense. And since I just mentioned Rav Bar Shalom, I'll just Derech Agav or as an addendum, I was sent from Israel this journal. It's called Beit Hillel. This rabbi in Israel sent me a whole bunch of them. I see, incidentally, it has a little article here by one of the people listening to it, Hoffman. And there's an article by Rabbi Eliyahu Bar Shalom, the one who I quoted, just quoted. It relates to something we spoke about in previous classes, about smoking. And he talks about how it makes no sense that we're so stringent on all certain areas of halakha, especially when it comes to weddings, and we ask the witnesses, you know, all sorts of things, and yet we have witnesses who smoke. And he says that's absolutely forbidden. Someone who smokes is unqualified for being a witness. He's causing great harm to his body. I think that's interesting. A couple other things before we start. I just want to clarify what I said last class. Okay, Rabbi Hoffman tells us that in Volume 9 he changes his mind and tracks what he wrote about having seen the women sing. I'm not sure exactly what he retracts and what he doesn't, so either you'll tell us or I will check later tonight. Let me write this down here. I want to clarify what I said about the briskers and the fast days, because I wasn't. There's a reason why I wrote this down, because sometimes I make mistakes if I don't write it down. Now, I originally heard this years ago from Rav Herschel Schechter, and I called the person who was involved, and I got the details, and this was Professor Aaron Schreiber, actually just passed away a few months ago. When I called him, before I was going to teach the class last semester, once again get to the bottom of this, he was already in a coma and you couldn't speak to him, but I did speak to his son. His son is, I think his son's name is Daniel Schreiber. He's published those volumes, Nora Otarav. He's not a YU person, but he's a Tarvadas person, but he put out about 15 little volumes of Rav Soloveitchik's Torah, and he told me the story, and the story wasn't Shivas Arba Tammuz. It was Tisha B'Av that Rav Simcha Sheps, who was a Rosh Yeshiva at Tarva Das, told this to his father, that he once visited the Brisker Rav in Jerusalem on Tisha B'Av, and he found him and his family eating. So again, what to make of this? It's I don't know what to make of this. This is very strange stuff, but that's the story as it comes from the source. Goes back perhaps to this notion that Rav Schechter records in Nefesh HaRav that the briskers hold that technically all fast days today, with the exception of Yom Kippur, are really optional. More things. I emailed a number of you. You were interested in this text I read to you from Orthodox Life in Frankfurt, which we spoke about, and I read you the piece about how in Hirsch's community, for example, they kept the key. They gave it to the janitor. So when you sold the chametz, let me read you something else that comes from there. Incidentally, one of you pointed out that Rabbi Billet also asks for the key, and I wasn't sure why. I said, what's the whole point? After all, if I'm at home, why can't I have the key? You know, what I have to. I think maybe, and someone can confirm this, it's that going away for Pesach, that's when Rabbi Billet wants the key, so that it's not a complete legal fiction, but that you can actually, the non-Jew could go in if he wanted to. The only other passage I wanted to read from you, which I forgot to mention, was, and I could send anyone this text if you're interested, it's from this, Newberger is his name, from Folgers Green. He wrote up his recollections. First of all, he speaks about how there was no children under 4 or 5 allowed in the great shul in Frankfurt, because obviously if you're in a German shul, you need to have decorum. But this is, I think, fascinating. He speaks about, first of all, talking in the shul was kept to an absolute minimum. And he says, no one was allowed to daven with their tallis over their head other than the Rav, and he only for Shmona Esrei. I read to you last time that he says shuckling was unheard of. But the idea that no one wore the tallis over their head, and the Rav, after all, this is another shul, where the Rav doesn't make the rules, the shul makes the rules. The Rav was not permitted to daven with the tallis over his head, except for Shmona Esrei. I wonder if any of you today have been to Washington Heights, if they continue with this minhag or not. I'd be quite surprised if they did. And finally, the last thing, I just want to read for Dovi Hoffman. I said last class I'd read to you what Rav Soloveitchik says in Halachic Man. And he puts the great emphasis on study for the sake of study, even though the Talmud seems to put the emphasis on practice. He raises this question. He says, this is on page 63, Talmud says, great is study, for study leads to action. Self is a bit of a paradox there, because there's a debate. What's greater, study or action? And they conclude study is, because study leads to action. Well, then it is study the most important, or is action? It's not clear. But he says as follows. However, even the norm is at the outset ideal, not real. Halachic Man is not particularly concerned about the possibility of actualizing the norm in the concrete world. He wishes to mint an ideal normative coin. So the action here is not action in the real world. It's what the halakha is in the ideal sense. The maxim of the sages, greatest study for study leads to action, has twofold meaning. One, action may mean determining the halakha or the ideal norm. Or two, action may refer to implementing the ideal norm in the real world. And he says that Halachic Man stresses the action in its first. I don't think this is historically the sense of the text at all. Say that study for the sake of action, I think they mean action in the real world. But from the Brisker perspective, action means action establishing what the theoretical halakha is, the norm, the ideal norm, not in the real world. But that's what he says. For those who are emailing me just privately, just wait till afterwards, and it's easier for me to answer it. Okay, let us continue now with the Ridbaz. We will conclude the Ridbaz today. I was reading last class, handed some of his selections from the introduction to his response on Beit Ridbaz. Let me call your attention to a couple other interesting passages here. The text, incidentally, is available on HebrewBooks.org for those who read Hebrew. A text like this really should be translated and published in translation in the Journal of American Jewish History. He talks about, I mentioned last class, how he's criticizing the rabbis. In another place, he talks about how many of these rabbis buy their positions. That was a big issue in Eastern Europe. People would pay off the community leaders to get their positions. And then he says that the children of the rabbis, b'nei ha-rabbanim u'b'noseihem g'ruim harbe yoter mi'b'nei ha-ba'abatim, that the worst ones are the children of the rabbis. And we have plenty of examples. Isaac Bar-Sheva Singer, we have many more like him, where children of the rabbis became, people went to yeshiva, became well-known heretics and opponents of the traditional system. It is all part of his criticism of Lithuanian society, especially rabbinic society. But it's not just Lithuania. Let me show you another interesting text. Rodney, I don't remember the title, but email me. I'll send it to you, because I only have the page here, not the title. Some of you might know this book. David Asaf, his collection of Hasidic essays on Hasidic history that came out a couple of years ago. And one of the most talked about essays deals with the world of Rav Yitzchak Nachum Twersky of Shpikov. He happened to be, important, I wouldn't say important, he came from a Hasidic dynasty. He himself became a quasi-Rebbe. He became the son-in-law of the Belzer Rebbe. What's important is that we have a letter from him. He was about 20 years old, written to a leading Maskil, telling about how he's trapped. He can't stand this life he's in. He ends up accepting it and living this way, but we have an insight into what his life was like and how he very much wanted to get out of it. But in the essay, Asaf quotes another author who writes about how B'neihem uvnoteihem shel hatzadikim hayu bein harishonim argish she'ein atid v'darkam shel avot, that it was precisely the daughters and the sons of the Hasidic leaders who often were the ones to see, he doesn't say often, who were the ones, the first ones to see that there was no place for them, that this life of theirs in the Hasidic world was something they had to leave behind. We have numerous examples of children, Hasidic Rebbes. I'm not talking about people like Heschel, who was involved in Judaism, was a religious person of a different sort. I'm talking about people who became completely irreligious, who became Bundists, who became communists, and if you want to read about a lot of the dirt, including children who intermarry, things of that nature. David Asaf has it all. He's the son of Moshe Kroner, an American Mizrahi figure. That essay created a bit of a controversy because a number of people thought, similar to what I published from Weinberg, that this was a personal letter. It was a long letter, something like 20 pages, not meant to be seen by the world at large. But the most popular article in this book, and the one that made the Israeli newspapers when it was originally published, deals with the son of Rav Shneur Zalman of Lodi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was an apostate to Christianity, then comes back to Judaism. This was always known in the Jewish world, even in the Hasidic world, but in the Chabad world, it wasn't talked about. And in later generations, they created all sorts of stories to cover it up. So the whole story is written in this book. Ritzbaz also speaks, this is on page 19, and I mentioned last class, if you recall, he distinguished between, actually this is page 17 when I'm going to read you, he distinguished between the Jews in America and the Jews in Lithuania. He came to respect the Jews in America, even when he first came to America. He had terrible things to say about Jewish life in America. He talks about how when the new immigrants would come to Ellis Island, they'd be met by people, Jewish social agency types, who would send them to different places in America where there'd be jobs waiting for them. The problem was they often send them to places where they'd have to work on Shabbos. So the Ritzbaz tells how he went to the office and he explained to these people who were not religious. Look, many of the people coming over were not religious. And many, obviously, people working there were not religious, but he explained to them that, this isn't right, that before they decide to send people to this place or that place, they should speak to them. Are you Shomer Shabbos? Is it important for you in a place where you don't have to work on Shabbos? And he says that they were happy to hear this. They accepted this, Beretzon Tov, very happily. And he says it continues to this day. And then he goes on, says, contrary to the people in my country, Achenu, Anshei Medinatenu, you should be embarrassed before Achenu Shav America, before the Jews of America. It used to be that you were the source of Torah and everything good in Yirat Shamayim and Lithuania. And who were the children of America? They were nobodies. They were terrible. But now it's turned. And everything is different. And if you want to see real piety, look to the Jews of America. Reflecting, I think, a couple of years of struggling to have to work on Shabbos, who respected the rabbis. Obviously, he has plenty of reasons to respect the rabbis. He thinks the situation is better in America than in Lithuania. He's on saying terrible stuff about Jewish life in Lithuania, and if you improved it, people wouldn't need to go to other lands. They would be happy to stay in Lithuania. The fact that everyone wants to leave Lithuania is because religious life there is so terrible. Now, he leaves after Sukkot at KJ. He goes on Aliyah, and not one to quietly live out his days. End of Israel. We have from Avraham Shapiro, who records this, obviously Torah Shabbat Pehi. We already know, as we've spoken about, Avraham Shapiro, Yerushalmi. He has all these Lithuanian traditions. And he tells that when he came to Eretz Yisrael, Rav Shmuel Salant was quite concerned, because we have a rabbinic phrase, you can't have two kings with one crown. And Rav Shmuel Salant knew, first of all, he's a tempestuous personality. Everywhere that the Ritzbaz had been, there had been machlokes, there had been trouble. The exact wording here. He says that Rav Shmuel Salant knew how great he was in Torah, when the Ritzbaz came, he said to him, "You know what? Go to Tzfat. Tzfat is a place that will need you. That needs you." And he worked to get him a nice position there in Tzfat, where the people support him. And then they asked Rav Shmuel Salant about this, Rav Shmuel Salant honestly said that he didn't want that the Ritzbaz should be with him in Jerusalem. And we can understand why. As it is, there was plenty of machokas in Jerusalem. Fiskin and others and all sorts of kataim and crazy people in Jerusalem. Not that the Ritzbaz was a crazy person at all, But Rabbi Shmuel Salant was the Rav of Jerusalem, and to have someone like Rav the Ridvaz, who was not going to play second fiddle, it would create all sorts of controversies. So Rabbi Shmuel Salant decides to send the Ridvaz up to Tzfat, and that's where he goes. But he wasn't one to stay quiet, and he assumes an important communal role. And during the Shemitah year of 1909 and 1910, he is the leading opponent of Rav Kook's Heter Mechira, Rav Kook's permission to sell the land to Arabs. He even goes to Western Europe, not an easy trip, but he travels to Western Europe to raise money for the farmers who are going to observe Shemitah according to Halacha without selling the land. It's on that trip that he gives Rav Herzog his smicha. But it's not just the Heter Mechira. The Ridbaz writes to Rav Kook. He could not understand why Rav Kook had such a positive view of these settlers. These people are coming to the land of Israel completely irreligious, and Rav Kook is embracing them. Despite this disagreement, though, Rav Kook and the Ridbaz continue to engage in very friendly correspondence. And I believe that one of Rav Kook's most incredible letters is written to the Ridbaz. It has yet been translated into English. If any of you want to have a task, it's worth doing. It's volume 1, number 555, 15 pages long, a real essay. And the context is Rav Kook responding to the Ridbaz, who's first of all furious at Rav Kook's attitude on the Heter Mechira, as well as his great openness to the irreligious. Rav Kook states, on page 186, Rav Kook says, "You find it wondrous that I'm makare de takol, that I bring everyone close. Damet Pusha Yisrael, even the sinners." We can't be anachronistic here. I mean, we have to understand something. This notion that we have today of Kiruv, this Lithuanian idea that Isha Torah or Sameach, this did not exist 100 years ago. There wasn't this conception that you reach out to the irreligious. On the contrary, you're supposed to keep the irreligious away from you. And the last thing you want is them to come to the land of Israel. For reasons we spoke about in previous classes, there is a whole movement of Kiruv now. The Ridbaz was not a believer in Kiruv, and neither were the other Gedolim at that time. And we've spoken about this. We don't need to go into great detail about it now. So the Ridbaz writes them, "Why are you being the Kari of these people? We have to separate from them." In order, Ridbaz says, "You think you're going to bring him back to Tshuva? Keep away from them." And I wrote to you, Rav Kook says, I hinted to you what my reason was, that anyone who understands Panimiot, you know, the secrets, Kabbalistic understanding of the Torah, their job is to la'asok b'tikun, be involved in building up those who have fallen in Kiruv Rechokim. So Rav Kook replies to the Ridbaz that the reason you oppose my Kiruv is because you don't have a Kabbalistic understanding. If you had a Kabbalistic understanding, you know that there's holy sparks in everyone, and even these irreligious people have holiness to them, they have a Jewish soul, all these things, and therefore I'm working to bring them back. Then he says, "And you, Ridbaz, you had a conflict between what I told you, that I'm reaching out to the Makarid people, and what we say in the davening. Mitpalim la'akram la'shabram, that birkat aminim. What do we say in davening? V'aminim al titikva, that the heretics, we don't want anything to do with them. We don't want them to survive even." And then Rav Kook says, "Listen to what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell it to you. I'm not going to speak Kabbalistically to you, because you're not interested in Kabbalistic things. You want, as he says, Dvarim Peshutim." And then Rav Kook explains his view of the non-religious and what they're contributing to the Jewish people. And on page 188, he says, incredible words, in justifying why he reaches out to the non-religious and explaining the theological reasons of the importance of the non-religious in today's day and age. He says, "Vashem Yodea, Shelo et kol haposhim ani mekarev." He says to the Ridbaz, "I don't reach out, I'm not makarev to all the non-religious. Ki im otam shani margish, shekoach seguri gadol munach betimi betim." Rachim rabim yesham lediyat zo. He says, "Only those who I feel have a special segura inside of them, a special characteristic, a special connection to Judaism." And then he goes on, But those who don't have this special characteristic, I follow what King David says. I hate them. And he goes on that most of the heretics have lost this special segula. This is a very important point. Rav Kook, in all his talk about reaching out to a non-religious, about the importance of the non-religious, not just reaching out, but to how they have a vital role in the eschatological era we're embarking on. He's not talking about the Bundists in Vilna. He's not talking about the assimilationists in London and Paris. He wanted nothing to do with them. He is speaking about those Jews in the land of Israel who sacrificed best years of their lives to come build up the land of Israel. They could have gone to America or South Africa or France, and yet they choose to come to the land of Israel. This notion that all Jews need to be reached out to, they're all precious, they're all very Chabad, very contemporary. I think we all believe in this today. But even Rav Kook did not believe in this. He didn't want to reach out to those people who we thought had already left us. They're a waste of time. We don't want them anymore. They're creating problems. We should be separate from them. But how do you see this special segula? It's the non-religious Jews that you reach out to. He explains on page 187 of the Yigrot that you look at those people who love the Jews, Jewish people, and those who love the land of Israel. You know, if you're talking about a Jew who goes to the land of Israel, I think today we can, I think Rav Kook would also say, if you deal with a non-religious Jew, let's say in Western Europe or America, he doesn't have to be in the land of Israel. But if he supports the land of Israel and he supports Jewish causes, those are the people who have this special segula, this special connection to Judaism, that we can't push them away and need to reach out to them. But the completely assimilated, the ones who want nothing to do with Judaism, like Chabad today, they go to the college campus and reach out to people who have nothing, and people don't even know they're Jewish and bring them back. From Rav Kook's perspective, that's not something we need to be concerned with. And certainly not the ones who grew up religious and who rejected it. Those are the real heretics. Rav Kook continues. This text, by the way, people haven't talked about it in a long time. It was resurrected at the time of the expulsion from Gaza. Because there, apparently, you had, in the eyes of some of the followers of Rav Kook, you had Jews who were doing really wicked, evil things. And they began speaking about them as really evil people. And many of the followers of Rav Kook opposed this. They said, no, we don't speak this way about our fellow Jews. And the distinction was made between these people, some of these people speaking very harshly, that these are not the people Rav Kook spoke about, that we have to reach out to them. Rav Kook also recognized there is evil and wickedness. And they cited this letter and other passages that these people, like in the government, they're the ones who are the evil ones. There was a big dispute in Rav Kook's own school, that is, the followers of Rav Kook. He continues. On page 194, also incredible, he says, you, Ridbaz, you're all upset with me, and you say that in my old age I've become a Zionist. And he then goes on and says, if the word Zionist means sacrifice themselves, build up the land of Israel, and they see this is important, and they believe that this is the land that God has given the Jews, then I'm proud to call myself a Zionist. On page 196, he says, Rav Ridbaz had written to him and said, despite everything I'm attacking you about Rav Kook, don't think that my love for you has in some way been extinguished. And Rav Kook replies, I never thought that. Of course I knew that we still were friends. And this is just a machokas l'shem shemayim. He says that I know everything, all the divrei kashot, all the harsh things, because the Ridbaz was speaking to him, and not just to him, he was speaking to other people about the craziness and the terrible things Rav Kook is doing. He says, I know that this is all l'shem shemayim. And finally, at the very end of the letter, apparently the Ridbaz had argued that there's a straight path. The Hebrew phrase is the holech batelem. You have to go the straight path in halacha. What the majority of poskim say, you can't come up with new ideas, new kulas, like Rav Kook is coming up with, the selling the land during the Shemitah year, and Rav Kook says, you're right. We should go in the straight path. However, there are times when, exact wording is, shehechrechu gadol, when it's an emergency, when there's a necessity, then there's time for us to look at darchei heter chadashim. We can have new ideas, novel ideas. And the fact that previous rabbis never thought of them, that's okay. Because, you know, that's the whole point of Torah study, that there are times to come up with new ideas. And he's particularly here speaking about the Heter Mechira. Fascinating dispute between the Ridbaz and Rav Kook. Now, there's a book that came out a couple of years ago, Derech HaTorah, Hitbonenut, an investigation into the life and thought of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. It's written by Rabbi Avihu Schwartz, Chaim Avihu Schwartz, who lives in Beit El. And he discusses this letter I just read to you, just summarized to you, and the dispute between the Ridbaz and Rav Kook, and he says something which I think is very insightful. He talks about the dispute over Kiruv and reaching out and the Ridbaz's position, and then he says, he talks about how Rav Kook was hopeful that these people would come back in the future, they'd return to Judaism, and then he says, it's only in our day, he says, how great was Rav Kook's vision? And it's only in our day that we see Rabim Chozrim Hayom B'tshuva. We see many people becoming Balei Tshuva. And actually not the students of Rav Kook coming back. Who are these Balei Tshuva? Elagam V'olai B'ikar. But perhaps even in the majority, Al Yidei Talmideim U'mamshichei Darkam Shal Elu Sha'az Hayumit Palim Aminim Alti Tikva. The ones who are responsible for bringing back most of the Balei Tshuva are not the followers of Rav Kook. Rather, it's the students of those people who their teachers said, Laminim Alti Tikva, that these heretics should all be wiped out. And they were saying it about the parents of the current Balei Tshuva. He goes on to say that the truth is that Rav Kook, although not directly, but his understanding and his vision, his influence, is over the whole Kiruv movement. But the great point here is that the very Haredi world, the spiritual descendants of the Ridbaz, they are the ones today leading the way in Kiruv, and yet it was their forefathers, two generations ago, who were saying just the opposite. No Kiruv to these people. We separate from them. We want nothing to do with them. And now the Kiruv is led precisely by the followers of them. I do think also Rabbi Schwartz is correct that the originator of Kiruv, the first one to speak about it, he wasn't speaking about it in the ways that they speak about it today. Like I said, going out to the far corners of the world, had no conception that you go to Alaska and Thailand to do Kiruv, but he was going to the non-religious kibbutzim, he was reaching out to people. Then, of course, Chabad comes on the scene, and now it's a growth industry, but I don't think it's just special pleading to say that Rav Kook is the originator of Kiruv. And you have to give Rabbi Schwartz credit and honesty for saying that the major force for Kiruv today is precisely in the Haredi world, and that's the great irony. That a couple of generations ago, they were saying that, it's not just a couple of generations ago, I mean, that's three generations or four generations was Baz, but two generations ago, Aaron Kohler and Shlomo Karlbach had to leave Lakewood because he wanted to do a form of Kiruv, and this was before Shlomo was involved in all the quasi-halachic things he did. And Rav Aaron and Lakewood as a whole, this notion that you stand on the street corner pulling on people, they thought this was terrible for a lot of reasons. They thought this was a terrible thing to do. How things have changed. Let me read you just one more thing. Let's see what we have here. They were concentrating on rebuilding then. Rebuilding what? The Haredi world was, before World War II, it was a huge world. There was nothing to rebuild. Oh, you're talking about after the war? No, I don't think that's it at all. I don't think it's a question of rebuilding. Rav Aaron Cutler was the same Rav Aaron Cutler before the war as after the war. We're going to have classes in Rav Aaron Cutler. He always was a Kanai, but the idea, whoever heard in Europe you had plenty of non-religious. You walked into Warsaw or Vilna, the majority of the population was non-religious. So you're going to start doing Kiruv? That wasn't no one had that conception. If there was a notion of Kiruv, then in Vilna, Rav Chaim Ozer would have set up a shop to do Kiruv. Rav Chaim Ozer wasn't doing Kiruv in Vilna. Why does Rav Aaron Cutler need to do Kiruv? And to go out to talk to non-religious people? That's dangerous. You send young people out there. Some of these people are very ignorant. Start talking to someone, and lo and behold, the person you're talking to knows more than the guy being Makarev. And, you know, the whole idea of Lakewood was to create a bastion of Torah study, not to go out At least that was Rav Aaron's position. Maybe today they say it would be different if it was if he was alive today. But I'm talking about if you speak to people who were around during those days. We're going to deal with Rav Aaron Cutler. I have some very good stuff on Rav Aaron Cutler. Next semester we'll do Rav Aaron Cutler maybe. Let's see. Money in Kirov, David says. Well, that gets back to what we dealt with Rav Shach, his criticism of Kirov, that it became a career. That people, as opposed to striving for greatness in Torah study, they want to then do Kirov. And it is true that you can go, but it's a nice career, I think most of us would say. After all, these are guys who are not trained, let's say, to have regular jobs and never been to college. So if they have a chance to do Kirov, and remember, they raise their own money. They always have to raise, they have to raise money for this, so there is an opportunity. Willing, I don't think in Vilna people will be willing to spend money to, for Kirov, but it's apparently it's possible to do that today, so that's also an aspect. You think that they're attracted to the Haredi world in spite of the fact that there's no Haredi? No, but it's, The Haredi world has a targeted Kirov today. Even at the college campuses all over the country, and they set up Lakewood, all the Lakewood Kollels. I told this story before. When I lived in Boston, they opened up the Lakewood Kollel there. And the Rosh Kollel there was completely frank to me, and I'm sure to other people as well, that why are they doing, that they're doing Kirov in the evenings, and he maybe was from the old school. He said he sort of didn't think that they should be doing this. But, he said the purpose of a kollel is just to learn, not to learn with people or anything like that. But he said that they need money, and this is a way of outreach. But for the younger people, and I learned with some of these people, they saw the evenings of when they were doing kirov and when they were learning as just as essential, maybe even more important than the daytime learning. They saw this as vital, and if you look at all the propaganda put out by the various kollels, they speak about the importance of Ayu kollels as well. But the Haredi kollels are all doing Kirov, and many of them are quite successful. Eshet Torah and Or Sameach, these are Haredi organizations. Abe Tropper, when he was something, he also was doing a lot of Kirov. So clarify, please, Rabbi Gross, what you mean by that they're not... I don't think that's the exception. I think most people from Makarev, let's say, take the ones who go to Israel. They go to the wall. How many people are brought in by Eshet Torah and Or Sameach? And people on college campuses, I know, because I worked as a chaplain at Brandeis for 3 years. We had these guys, not one, we had about three or four different types who came in. Some guy from, some of you might know him, Benji Jacoby from Toronto. Then we had these Eshet Torah ones and others. They would come for Shabbos. People would be interested. They'd give them money. They go on a Shabbaton. They have this the weekend they had. They'd send them to Israel discount. And so for 15 or every 20 or 15 they send, one of them becomes interested, turned on. He decides to stay in Israel because they might offer him a free year at yeshiva there. Or he comes back and goes to yeshiva. So it is targeted. I don't know. Maybe things are different out by you. I don't think they're just walking into, just out of the blue into some Haredi institution. There's definite outreach in the Haredi world, and very successful outreach. And I saw when I was in Boston a distinction because the Rosh Kollel himself said that this was not really what it's about. They have to do this. And the younger people, on the contrary, thought this was what this indeed was about. That you can't just, like the Dubna Magid said to the Vilna Gaon, the famous story is that the Vilna Gaon asked the Dubna Magid, give him some Musar. The Dubna Magid is supposed to give the Vilna Gaon Musar? What kind of question request is that? But the Gaon insisted, and the Dubna Magid said he shouldn't be a tzaddik just in his little room. He should go out in the world, try to influence people. He's not talking about Kirov there. He's talking about the community as a whole. Maybe that's a bad thing, because maybe it was after that the Vilna Gaon decided to put the Hasidim in Cheirim. But point being that there's been different approaches. So let me see some of these questions here. No, I don't. Okay. Targeted Giur. Yes, David's correct. There's targeted Giur by this EJF. That's true. What Yisrael says is correct. Although there is NCSY, and there why you used to have something, why you never really took this great importance. They ceded this area to the Haredi world. And in the 1970s, the area was open. And they could have had a strong outreach. And there were certain rabbis who did. Saul Berman, for example, out in Berkeley the same time as Shlomo Carlebach. But for the most part, modern Orthodox people, that wasn't something they wanted to do. Rabbis didn't want to. And there was a time that only Chabad would go to these strange places, and now you have the Haredi world. But you're right, the modern Orthodox is just one of many things that the modern Orthodox did step up to the plate to. I think this goes back to something we've said a number of times, that the modern Orthodox fundamentally has often been focused on two groups, the intellectuals and the wealthy, as the upper middle class modern Orthodox types. They've never really had an outward vision for others. And you have to give the Haredim credit for that. They propagated Judaism. That's very different. You can live in a Haredi community and send your kid to day school for, what, $4,000 or $5,000 a year? Someone who's interested in becoming modern Orthodox, they might like the lifestyle and it agrees with them more. When you hear what the tuition at the schools are and camps and all this, I think 95% of them just say, I want nothing to do with this. So it's much more difficult to sell the modern Orthodox. Also, it requires, if you're not going to sell people on the lifestyle, modern Orthodox light. They're not changing their whole lifestyle to adopt what they think is a lifestyle of compromises. Or what modern Orthodoxy is about all sorts of people at the religious levels, which is a good thing. But people who are changing their life, usually they want something, want to become true believers, not people who grow up in it as part of a culture, which many in the modern Orthodox world are. So that leaves you then with the intellectual modern Orthodox. But the average person who wants to become religious is not an intellectual. They're not going to find themselves, you know, hanging out at the Orthodox Forum. So really, modern Orthodoxy doesn't have much to offer for most. I want to mention two other things before we conclude with the Ridvaz. He dies, incidentally, in 1913 at age 68. He had one other interesting point. I mentioned this, but I'll say it again. Now, in addition to his opposition to the Brisker method, he tells his sons, do not take rabbinic positions. It turns out they weren't rabbis anyway, but this would apply to his son-in-law, I think, also, Joseph Konvitz, who was with them in Tzfat and then comes to Newark, the father of Milton Konvitz. Do not take a position. His family, none of his descendants should take a position in Russia for four generations. He was so turned off by living in Russia and Lithuania, by what it was, what it did to him, that for four generations, he puts an oath, as it were, on his descendants. Don't step foot in that land. Don't go anywhere near there. It's terrible. He also, when he lived there, incidentally, he himself had even been put in jail for a short period of time. There was an accusation that he was an anarchist and a socialist. So some of his enemies accused him of that. But that's not what he's talking about. He's not talking about the government here. I'm certain he's talking about Jewish life. He watched how Jewish life in Russia and Lithuania had just disintegrated. And it did, before his eyes. He saw the destruction from his youth, not just his youth, when it was completely religious, when no one would dream of opening a store on Shabbos. But by the time he left Lithuania, and every city you had streets there where Jews had their stores open on Shabbos. He also supported the reinstitution of the Sanhedrin, which puts him really ahead of his time. Finally, let me read you something that Rav Avraham Shapiro tells. One more story, and make of it what you will. I'm not sure exactly what to make of it, but he tells actually two stories right at the end of his book. You know, this story comes, Tzvi Yehuda tells Rav Avraham Shapiro this. This comes to when the Ridvaz first comes to the land of Israel in 1904. He stays in Yafo, before he goes to Tzfat with Rav Kook. He stayed with him, and he told this story to Tzvi Yehuda. Again, take it for what it's worth. He had many problems, as we know. Wherever he went, he had problems. And one time, he was so angry at his shul, at his people, that is, he opened up the Aron Kodesh with all the community there, and he cursed five of his six opponents. He had six big opponents, and he cursed five of them, and he said that they would not live out the year. That when he came down from the Bima, they asked him, aren't you afraid you are going they're going to live out the year, and then it's going to make you look like a fool? And this is the story he's telling with Tzvi Yehuda. So if it's not true, it's because the Ritva's is exaggerating. He says he went up again to the Bima, and he says, I promise you that you will not last the year. And so it happened. And then Ritva's gave the reason. He says, when I curse you, the Torah is cursing you. And when the Torah is cursing you, great fire is going to come upon you. Now, I'm going to write about this on the future Svarim blog. I don't know if Avraham Shapiro realizes this. He's quoting word for word. He says the word fire, that's actually the name of one of the opponents, one of the great opponents of the Ritva's in Slutsk. In fact, he was a Rav, opposing Rabbanim there. So there's a whole story to that. And then he tells another story. The Ritva's asked, he made a decree, whatever that means, that from now on he would not be paid his salary by the community leaders. The way it was, or the community leader, the way it was that they'd collect, let's say, a tax from all the people in the community, and the Yoshev Rosh, the Rosh HaKal, the president, I guess, of the community, would pay him his salary. The problem was disputing with the president. The president refused to pay him his salary. Either he wouldn't pay him on time, or he just decided he's not going to pay him. That was his way of getting back at him. So the Ritva's made a decree, therefore, that all the individuals in the community should themselves come and give me the money. That is, individually, they're required to come and drop off the money. They want to be part of, recognized as part of the community. In other words, if they want to be as do all these things. Rather than them giving it to the headman, who then could use it against the Ritva's, they would each have to drop it off. Okay, with that, we conclude the Ritva's. Before we start, we have some time to start with Rav Henkin. I'll just ask, does anyone have any questions about the Ritva's on things we didn't speak about? Wait one more minute. He claims that those three died that year. Yeah. This isn't a Hasidic story. This is a Litvish story. But that's what he told. So if you don't want to believe it, don't believe it. But that's what the Ritva's, that's the story the Ritva's told. Okay, let us move on then. We now are going to begin for the next couple of classes, great, great scholar, Rav Joseph Elijah Henkin. Rav Joseph Elijah Henkin, there's a picture of him from older years. Rav Henkin was the leading posek in America in the 1940s and 1950s, and as such, certainly worthy of our examination. I think his son, Louis Henkin, famous professor of law, is more famous than him. But he was a very important posek, and he has many interesting things to say that are not concerned with halacha. Let's begin, though, with his biography. And for this, I'm relying on two sources. He has a very great grandson. Not a great-grandson, but a grandson who is great. Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, author of four volumes of Responsa called B'nei Panim. And in one of the volumes of Responsa, he has a biography of his grandfather. And in this, and in the volumes, throughout the volumes, he's always quoting his grandfather. Because Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, as far as I know, never studied in the yeshiva. He was a Flatbush graduate, and then he studied with his grandfather for a while. And so throughout his writings, he's always quoting his grandfather. And two, there's an annual or a semi-annual called Yeshurin. It's very thick. It's about 700-800 pages each volume. And a couple of years ago, son of Yehuda Herzl Henkin, his name is Eitam Henkin, and he had a long article about his grandfather with all sorts of details. So those are the two major sources. Rav Henkin is born in 1881. The small town, Klimovitz, is I guess how you pronounce it, in Bella Russia or White Russia. His father was a Talmud Chacham, which is significant because not all the people we've spoken about came from parents who were Talmud Chachamim, fathers. His father even had a yeshiva. Rav Henkin studied in town, and also his future father-in-law had a yeshiva in a town near Klimovitz, and he went and studied there. Now, His original name, birth name, is Eliyahu Yosef, Elijah Joseph Hinken. But when he comes to America, he begins to call himself Yosef Eliyahu Hinken. Why? I asked his grandson. His grandson doesn't know. He assumes that Ellis Island, the name was switched, although it's hard to imagine that because a clerk at Ellis Island switches your name, that you're going to change your name. And not just that, he was called up then differently to the Torah. So I don't know. At age 15, he travels to Mir. Mir is actually, after Volozhin, is the oldest. He travels to Mir to study there. But he was too young. At age 15, he was regarded as too young. He wasn't allowed into the yeshiva. So he travels to Karlin, where he studies in the local Beis Medrash, and they set him up to eat at people's houses. The way it worked, before the yeshiva system got going, where they had dormitories. First yeshiva, I believe, that had a dormitory in which they fed people. If you didn't have a dormitory where you could feed them, was Chachmei Lublin, Yeshiva's Chachmei Lublin, which today, if you go to Lublin, you'll see it. I think they turned it into a medical school. Before that, everyone lived in people's houses. Either they came with money, or some of them were given a little stipend from the yeshiva, and they rented a room, and they did not always eat at the people whose rooms they rented. Usually the case was they had eating days. That is, the people in the community were very generous that they'd set it up. I think this only was probably for one meal a day, but every day you went to someone different. So people in the community, I'm from Scranton. I know that there have been families in Scranton who the yeshiva bachurim there on Shabbos. They would invite the yeshiva bachurim. This was every day you'd eat at a different person's house. You can never have a situation like this today, I think, because the yeshivas would probably, they wouldn't trust the kashrus of the people in town probably enough to do that. Maybe if you're in a completely Haredi community, but remember, there wasn't such thing as Haredi. There wasn't such thing as a Haredi. These are just regular communities, Balabatim. And yet everyone went to eat at their houses. From Karlin, after studying there, he goes to Slutsk, where he studies for 6 years, and he becomes very close to Rav Issur Zalman Meltzer. Rav Issur Zalman Meltzer is the Rav of Slutsk and also has a yeshiva there. According to his grandson, when Rav Issur Zalman would leave Slutsk, he would leave Rav Hinken in charge of the yeshiva, even though Rav Hinken was quite young. At age 20, Rav Hinken receives smicha from the Ridbaz, Rav Baruch Ber Leibovitz, and the Aruch HaShulchan. And the Aruch HaShulchan is important, because we'll see soon what Rav Hinken says about the Aruch HaShulchan. In 1902, when he's 21 years old, he marries. And he remains in Slutsk for a while, and then he travels to a place that's called Uni. That's how you pronounce it, to serve as rabbi. It's near the Turkish border. I think it's in Georgia. In those days, rabbis would go wherever they could to get a parnasa. Maybe rabbis today also do that. But this was not an Ashkenazi community. This was a Sephardic community and people who were very ignorant. They had all sorts of strange practices. Let me give you some examples. When a woman was a nida, the women wouldn't work or touch food. If someone was ill, they would bring incense into the room and drive away the demons. There's actually a whole sefer that speaks about this. I wrote about it on the Sfarim blog. A whole sefer written about this practice, because in Syria this was common also. The rabbis wanted to ban it. This idea of using incense to drive away demons. This is a form of idolatry. And yet, that was what people did. When people died, they would dress up the dead person. They would beautify the dead person, and they would put food and money in the grave, almost like the ancient Egyptians. This was a community where every single person was Shomer Shabbos, was Shomer Kashrus, pious community, but completely ignorant. No one knew anything. There wasn't one person there who could read, I'm assuming, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And Rav Hinken comes there and he finds all these strange practices, practices that developed over the generations. There's actually responsa about these practices in the responsa of Rav Malkiel Tzvi Tenenbaum. He's known as the Divrei Malkiel. Because for some of these practices, Rav Hinken thought that they were completely lesser. He had to uproot them. It's idolatrous. Others, it's not so clear. You know, sometimes people in the community, the masses, do all sorts of foolish and stupid things. But if they're used to doing that, and they get some sort of spiritual sustenance, that doesn't mean you need to go out and you know, tell them what they're doing is crazy. After all, the practices could be harmless. I'm sure all of us know about all sorts of practices. Emails come across all the time from the various shul listservs about how do this, it's a segula. This is a segula for that. That's a segula for this. I spoke about one last semester with the red ribbon, business, because that might have been idolatrous. But these people do all sorts of strange things. There was someone who came to the town next to me, Livingston, New Jersey, to sell holy water. So whatever holy water is. So that's what the different Malkiel discusses in these responsa, what Rav Henkin should do about these practices. I think it's like four or five different responsa. In 1903, he returns to Belorussia. He gets a position there. City of announced, I think, Smolyan in 1914, and he remains there for 9 years. In 1920, his wife actually dies during childbirth. This was her seventh delivery, and the child dies shortly after that. So here we have Rav Henkin in 1920. Six children, no wife. He soon remarries, though. Obviously, this finds a woman who's a tzedekes to marry someone with six children. But shortly after that, the area comes under communist control, and he knows he has to leave. His wife's brother lives in America. He was able to get the documents for Rav Henkin at the end of 1922. He leaves Russia, and this again brings up the old question we've spoken about: what is the responsibility of a rabbi to his flock, Soviet Union, let's say, even not in Germany and Nazi Germany? Should he stay with his flock? You know, many rabbis, they write biographies of many rabbis in Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, and they speak about, even though this communist came to power, Rabbi so-and-so would not leave his flock. He remained with them to the end, giving them spiritual sustenance. That's great praise indeed of this rabbi. But the flip side and the implication of it is a criticism of those rabbis who didn't remain with their flocks and chose to leave. But then what's the point then of the great praise? We know that when Rav Moshe Feinstein in the 1930s came to America, he thought that he would be shunned by the citizens of America, by the Jewish citizens, because they would regard him as someone who abandoned his role. The job of a rabbi is to remain in the community, and Rav Moshe left. And maybe there were people who thought that way. Obviously, it's not for us to judge, and I don't know if a rabbi needs to stay with his flock if there's no future for his own children, and what he's supposed to do. In any event, Rabbi Henkin leaves and comes to America. And he becomes the rabbi of a small shul. It's hardly what we call making a living. The shul itself, as all these small shuls, they never paid a salary. You made a living because if you had a shul and people came to your shul, and this is the great, this ties into the dispute we spoke about of Album and the Ridvaz, they would ask you to do weddings and funerals and all, sell the chametz. That was always a big money maker. That's how you made your parnasa. You're never given a salary. So if you see how a number of these rabbanim on the side, they talk about them being in Brooklyn, of rabbis of a few different shuls. You have another number of cities where the United Orthodox congregations, there used to be a number of shuls, and then they joined together. Sometimes they even were separate, and they called them the United Orthodox congregations. This meant that the Rav was the Rav of, let's say, four or five shuls. He'd go to a different shul, because the more shuls there are, the greater chance of making a parnasa. But he wasn't making a parnasa. And in 1925, he's appointed director of an organization, a new organization. It was founded about 10 years before, called Ezras Torah. It was founded by the Agudas Rabbanim, the organization of European rabbis in America, really Lithuanian rabbis in America. And its job was to support poor Torah scholars. In those days, although America wasn't, the streets were not paved with gold, there was more money in America than there was in Eastern Europe. Was so poor. And the rabbis, and there were Jews who were making it big in America, and Jews who were still interested in giving money to Jewish tzedakahs. They opened up this organization called Ezras Torah. The job was to raise money, and Rav Henkin would travel all over America. The stories about him are legendary. First of all, about his self-sacrifice. He'd leave his wife and family for weeks at a time. He would travel months at a time. He'd travel out west, all these small towns. My family comes from Fargo, North Dakota. Rav Henkin would go to places like Fargo. He'd come for Shabbos and speak about the importance of Ezra's Torah, and people would give him money, and this money would then be sent, it was to both the land of Israel and Europe, to support Torah scholars there, to support yeshivas there. very important in those days. And Rav Henkin himself made a living from this. He was paid very little. He was legendary about he refused to take any raise. But that's how he made a living, as a rav in a small shul and working for Ezra's Torah. Next class, we're going to speak about the development of him as a posek and some of his very interesting ideas. Let me get to, it's already 10 o'clock though, so let me stop here, we'll get to some of the questions. So we hear that it's again in the, yes, Essentag, that's the eating days. Well, Kest, when you went to your father-in-law, no. Kest really is when you'd be supported by your father-in-law. That was called Kest. Eating days, and so if you ate with your father-in-law, that's the Kest. Eating with a different person every day of the week, that's what they called Essentag. And in all the literature that I know of, I've never once, in all the responsa literature, which discuss everything about Jewish community, never once, as far as I know, and I know a lot of these volumes, is it ever raised, to my knowledge, that there's a problem. Some kid was going to be eating at someone's house, and the Rav has to tell him, you really can't eat there. The kashrus is not reliable. The person was a Shomer Shabbos, and as part of the community, the house was reliable. Now, the yeshiva in Lublin is again in Polish Jewish hands. I'm sure that's going to be a big debate. We need to send Jews back to Poland to send yeshiva bachrim back. What's the point of sending yeshiva bachrim back to Poland to create an institution? Because we once had an institution there, and therefore we need to create it. Some of you might know that the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary was reconstituted last year. They even have a website. They asked me to come to speak there. I'll come. If they want to pay my flight, I'll go. I'm not going to go by my own, pay my own way, though. They reconstituted the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. They're very excited. They want to find out all the information about Rabbi Weinberg and Avram Eliel Kaplan and put it all on their website. I asked them a very interesting question, though. I said, "And you call yourself the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary and see yourself as the continuation of the prior Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, the Yale one." Said to them, though, "Do you have a Torah Eretz ideology, or are you just a Haredi institution?" And the guy said, honestly, he says, "No, we don't have a Torah Eretz ideology." So, my standpoint, what's the point of having a Berlin Rabbinical Seminary if you can call it the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, but if it's not preaching the ideology of Torah and Western culture of the original one, then in what sense is it the historical continuation? So I told this to the guy, the man who's running it, a very nice man, and he said, "Well, today that's not so relevant. They're really interested in reaching out to the Russian community, which is very big now. There's over 100,000 Jews in Germany. They're training rabbis to reach out to the Russian community. They don't need to train rabbis like the old Berlin Rabbinical Seminary who'd be able to deal with Western." All that, okay, maybe. And he did say they're not opposed to Derech Eretz. They're not a Haredi yeshiva in the sense that they're not opposed to Derech Eretz. They just don't advocate it. They're sort of in the middle. They don't take a position either way. But to go back to Poland, just because there once was a yeshiva in Lublin, why Lublin? Not Volozhin. The Volozhin yeshiva building is also there. Why not reestablish a yeshiva in Volozhin? Well, maybe the fact that there's no Jews in Volozhin is good enough reason. I was in Lublin. There's no Jews there. I don't know. I personally see this as a waste of money. We don't send Jews back to what we call the Eretz Adamim. If Jews come to Germany, as they had, we need to be with them. But there's no Jews in Poland, so we need to send Bachrim there to learn there because 70 years ago, there was a yeshiva there. I don't get it. It seems to me a big waste of money. Let's see, what else do we have here? I'm going to turn up the screen here so I can see things better. I don't know if that's true, surely that his teeth were falling out. I know Rabbi Henkin. I will email Rabbi Henkin. We know that they tried to give him a raise in the salary, and he wouldn't take it. Very difficult to get him. I guess there were times he had to take it, but very mocked it. He would sometimes be there late at night on weekends, and his attitude was they're paying him for certain hours, and if he's on the phone or something, if his wife were to call him, let's say, and to ask him some questions, I don't know, the kids need to be picked up or something, he would see this as wasting time. And therefore, in his mind, he would have to stay 5 more minutes or do 5 more minutes extra in addition to what he always would do extra, but he was especially makpid on time. But as for his teeth falling out, I don't know. By the way, it's not just Rav Henkin, Rav Lichtenstein. I remember when I was in Israel 25 years ago, Professor Breyer, who I don't even know if he's still alive anymore. Menachem Breyer was one of my teachers. Meyer Breyer, the brother of Menachem Breyer from IU. And he had a position at Gush then, maybe the executive director, and he told me that for years they were trying to give Rav Lichtenstein a raise, and he refused to take it. So they came up with this stunt. I guess that's what you can call it. They said that someone sent what would $500 be then? I don't know. $1,000, $1,500, whatever. We're not talking about a lot of money, but that was what they were going to give. They wanted to give him extra. They said that someone from America sent this. I think he said $500. Maybe it was $1,000 as a gift for Rav Lichtenstein, and they don't know who it is. It's an anonymous gift. And therefore, he couldn't return it or refuse to accept it. And what does Rav Lichtenstein do? He takes the money with cash, and he goes down to the bank and he pays the fee. There was a fee in those days to change money from dollars to you have to go, technically you had to go to the bank to change money from dollars to shekels or lira in those days. But no one did that. Everyone changed money on the side. And Rav Lichtenstein even said that you probably could because the government itself was not careful about it. But Rav Lichtenstein took this money, these dollars, and rather than changing it with anyone, he went down to the bank and changed it, and they took out however much money they took out. I remember when I was in yeshiva in those days, I said, to go down to the bank, you'd have to wait online. It could take you half hour just to change the money. How can you have a policy where you're obligated to waste your time like that? There was a scandal. Okay, is this in, you have to tell me if that's in the literature. I don't know if that's discussed in the tshuva literature. I have no doubt that there was a case or two, but the fact that someone like myself who reads all day writings from Eastern Europe, and I've never seen a case like that, and there's all sorts of cases from written that goes on in the shtetls. You have adultery, you have people attacking each other physically, all sorts of terrible stuff going on in the ghetto. Girls getting pregnant. Everything you can imagine is being discussed. But I do not recall any tshuva or any sermon that discusses this issue of or newspaper article of that someone in the community was not reliable. Obviously, there are people who were in kosher, but you didn't send them to them. But the idea that someone who's in the frum community, that you'd say you can't send them there. You wouldn't send them to the Mechalei Shabbos, obviously. So I think that is significant. Remember, we're talking about an era where people had inns. Everywhere you went, you stayed at an inn, or you stayed at someone's house. There was no such thing as hashkacha. There was no rabbi who'd come in and check. If I want to open an inn, I open an inn, and someone stays with me. And it's all like the old inns in the American West. I would serve them breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You still have one of these inns, I think in by Hunter Mountain. Now I see it's under hashkacha, but for years it wasn't. That's the old way of doing things. If someone's a frum Jew, you assume he's a frum Jew. And just like you can eat at someone's house on Shabbos if they invite you, you can stay at his house, and he can make you food. That's the old approach. He's no longer alive, fortunately. Now we see he's alive and well. Very nice. And Yishal, you must be thinking of Menachem Breyer, who's the father-in-law, and also he was the son-in-law of the Bionner Rebbe. When the Bionner Rebbe died, the Bionner Shtiebel in New York, they wanted him to take over. But he's more of a, he was a modern guy. He was actually a sheriff. Catskills in the summer. He wasn't the sort of person who, they were from Romania, these people, prayers. He wasn't going to take over as the Chassidish Rebbe. So his son-in-law became the Bionner Rebbe. His son-in-law, I think, went to MTA. But he's the Bionner Rebbe. If you're in Jerusalem, you can go. I think it's a real Chassidus now, Bion. You talk about the Kashrus approach, Shuli? We're going to talk next class. Hold the question to next class, because Rav Henkin speaks about Kashrus. It's during Rav Henkin's time that the Hashkachas start up on products. And Rav Henkin deals with the issue, do we need to have Hashkachas on products? Because there weren't any Hashkachas on products. It used to not be. And the OU starts up with Hashkachas, and Rav Henkin deals with this question. So when we deal with that, I'll talk about some of the other issues of Hashkachas. Okay, I'll stay on another minute or two if anyone else has anything else. Okay, Yisroel. I think it's a common thing to challenge them. Rav Moshe Feinstein and Igros Moshe has a letter to Rav Soloveitchik about issues dealing with the Vatican. You're saying before condemning them. I think the difference is that these rabbis were friends with each other. They knew each other. So therefore, they would challenge them. And if you look at the Ritvaz, you might even think that he went too far. After all, the Ritvaz is a strange person in that he could be a good friend with you, and he doesn't see that as meaning that he can't publicly attack you. Most people, let's say in the academic world, if someone asks me to review a book, and I think the book is terrible, but it's written by my friend, I won't review it. Because I don't think you can separate the personal from the professional so easily. There are people in the academic world who think the two are different, and they'll write a review, blast someone, and they'll still think that they're friends with them and assume that the person should not take offense because they're not dealing with him personally, they're just dealing professionally. The Ritvaz thought that he could blast Rav Kook and he could write letters to Rav Kook blasting him, but this is all L'shem Shemayim, and therefore no one should take offense. Is that most people do take offense, right, like this. Today, however, people are not friends. Some of these rabbis in one community have nothing to do with the rabbis in the other communities. They want to call Rav Druckmann a heretic, they have nothing to do with Rav Druckmann. They've never met him, they never spoke to him. It's very easy. You will see in my few, I consider myself a very, pretty good friend with Michael Broyd. We'll see how he reacts to my article, because I do criticize him, but we've had our back and forth in the past, and he's a big mensch about this. He's criticized me sharply, I've criticized him. I don't take it personally, and I know he doesn't take it personally. I think that's good. On the other hand, sometimes criticism can be so strong. I've never read Chaim Soloveitchik's criticism. It's hard to come back after that, and... Okay, we'll talk about this next class. In one word, Rav Moshe Feinstein. But we'll talk about this next class, how Rav Henkin rose to the top and then was eclipsed by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Okay, well then, I will end now. We will obviously pick up next week dealing with Rav Henkin, probably two more classes on Rav Henkin before we move on to Rav Eliezer Berkovitz. But as I said, there's a lot of interesting stuff about Rav Henkin, including some stuff that some of you might be troubled with. His views about Zionism, for instance, are not what you'd expect from a rabbi such as Lithuanian Rav or someone like Rav Henkin. Not when you know who is. So there's a lot to do. To be continued. Bye-bye.